Hey everyone, you can now hear How Did I Get Here along with 5,000 other shows on Stitcher Smart Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly from your iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, or Palm phones, on demand and on the go. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com or in the app stores. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Alright? Do that. Download it. App Store. Let's get down, people!
And you may ask yourself,
how did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Holly.
All right. How are you? I hope you're doing well. I'm Johnny. I'm your host. I'm here. I'm doing it. It's Monday. If you're listening to it to the day that this comes out, it comes out on Tuesday or so. But it's Monday to me, right here. And tomorrow is the ham day. The ham benefit day, which is taking place all over town. Everyone should go. If you're in Austin, you're listening to this tomorrow, Tuesday, October 2nd. So we're in October now. October! Rocktober! Yeah. I had a pretty subdued weekend. I went to, I played a gig on Friday at Hotel Vegas with my friend John, and went out and had some cocktails afterwards. Saw some old friends I haven't seen in a while. Ran into a guy I went to high school with, who's a chef. Amazing guy, John. Great to see him. It was great to play the gig. It was great to see John Leffler. Great to see him play. And I had a great time. And then I've been staying at an old girlfriend of mine's house who we share custody of our dogs. And she left on Friday, so I stayed there all weekend. I didn't really do anything the rest of the weekend. I just chilled out with my guys. Just me and the dogs. Some cable, you know, playing outside. It rained one day. So whatever. That's my life this weekend. It's not terribly exciting, but it's fun. I'll tell you that right now. Super fun. And if you need to know what's happening on The Real Housewives of New York, I'm totally caught up. My guest today is an amazing singer-songwriter. I've known him for probably a little over 20 years. We talk about this a little bit. I met him. I lived in a recording studio, and he went in there to make a record, and I was kind of like the guy that made coffee and hung out and was weird there, recording on his four-track in the front room in this big recording studio. Anyway, so Michael's a great guy. He's just put out his eighth record just last year, and we actually filmed a pilot last year. We kind of talk about it a little bit for this show where you get together. We wrote a song together, and then we recorded it live with a band that day, and it was very fun. I've been a big fan of Michael's for a long time. I love his voice. I love his songs, and he's a very interesting guy, so I'm glad he was able to make it down. I had to postpone it last week because of the loss of a friend. I would like to send a lot of love out to Brenda Hutchinson, her family. Her fiancé, Mark, is a good friend of mine, and I love them all very much, and my heart goes out to them. But I'm glad Michael was able to reschedule. He came by this morning before he went to go write a song with someone, and so this is this is like a hot off the press. Just done, coming out, coming at you, if you know what I mean. Anyway, so I'm glad Michael was able to come by. We talked about his whole life, growing up in Ohio, leaving Ohio, going to New York, coming to Austin, and making records and putting them out. He's a great guy. I love him. I'm glad he came by. And without further ado, here is my conversation with the fabulous Michael Fracasso.
I'm giving up the bad things, the hurtful things I've done. I ain't giving up on your love while the night is young. Will someone call the doctor? The healing has begun. I found a cure in your love while the night is young. And I don't believe for
me. So that's from St. Monday.
Yes, that is.
Is that that's your eighth album?
Seventh studio album. Yeah, yeah.
And you did this one differently, is what I understand. You brought in a not your normal kind of producer.
Yes, a guy who never produced any record before.
Wait, hang on one second. I'm going to turn up the AC before it goes on.
Uh huh.
So to me, that is a... sorry, I'm so pro. To me, that's a great idea. It's kind of almost like the Andy Warhol Velvet Underground album or something.
Is it? That's interesting, yeah. I mean, well, interesting in a sense, in a couple ways. It's the first, you know, I used to live in New York for a long time, and it's the first New York-ish, it's the most New York record I've ever made by far. You know, I tried, and I think the producer either consciously or subconsciously tried to eliminate all my Austin influences.
Right.
In this record, you know, and he was very instrumental in editing what material went into it as well.
Yeah. And his name's Jim Lewis?
Jim Lewis, yeah. And he's a novelist. He's written 3 novels, and he's a writer for, like, GQ and the New York Times. Does a lot of travel pieces. And
does he do music critic? Is he a music
critic? No, he's an art critic.
Okay.
He writes a lot of... he's, like... does a lot of art, the beginning of art books and
right.
things, you know, but basically on artists, not like.
So what yeah. how did that happen?
Like, well, because I you know, yeah, no, we're friends and we were hanging out, and I loved his take on my music, in general. And, he had a lot of great ideas about what he heard in my music, and I said, well, let's give it a shot. And he was taken aback. You know, what do you mean? I said, yeah, you should produce me, and I think it'll be great. And yeah. And truthfully, I after I said that, and, you know, when we went in the studio, I thought, oh, fuck, I'm out of my mind.
Yeah,
it's going to be horrible. And there is that little dance where I wasn't sure that I trusted him, even though I asked him, and I think that he was uncomfortable as well, because he had never done, you know, a studio record or any producing before, and didn't know the language.
Right.
And it was frustrating for just about a week. He's like a quick study. I mean, he read everything. Understood everything, and, you know, in a week he knew, you know, everything about producing.
Right.
Yeah. So.
And you engineered it. Was that the first record that you've engineered?
No, I don't look at myself as an engineer.
Right.
You know, and that was a little bit painful, frankly. I'm not a very good engineer. A lot of it's luck. And it's great when the luck is on your side.
Right.
For me, anyway, as an engineer,
right.
I find that too can be helpful, because some engineers, they just go do the same thing all the time.
Right.
And it's very bland.
Yeah.
And because I didn't, it wasn't bland, but sometimes it's glaringly not right either, you know, so...
But in an incredible way, I think it's good.
You can find yourself really in a good place with mistakes. For
yeah,
sure. Yeah.
So you have a studio at your house?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it as extravagant as
this? Yeah, and I was just gonna say, not unlike this studio.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So do you record on Pro Tools or something?
I do. I have Logic Express, but I also have a board tape. I use a quarter-inch tape that I record onto first.
Oh, okay.
And then I run it into the computer.
And so did you record live a lot of this record? Because
the tracks
are kicking really piecemeal?
It was me in the rhythm section.
Okay.
And all my stuff was scratch stuff. Except for we did 2 tracks with George Reeve in his studio.
Uh-huh.
And, well, those 2, no, everything was, all my stuff was scratch, vocal and guitar.
Right.
And then I redid everything. And that's the first time I've ever done that. I've always been afraid of that process. Like, I wouldn't be able to do that. And over the years, you know, I've gone in and sang on other people's records, and, And on probably on each of my records, there's a track where I had to go and redub my vocal, you know, redo my right. vocal or something like that. So
we did that live thing last year.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I've had some experience
yeah.
with that, but this is the first time I did a whole record that way.
Right.
Knowingly doing it. Like, I knew from the beginning that I wasn't holding on to any of these tracks because I didn't have the right mics on the guitar or my voice or whatever. Right. So.
Did you have to borrow a lot of stuff, or do you have some stuff there?
Oh, I borrowed stuff. Yeah. But that's, yeah, it was cool. I mean,
so where does
cool
that leave
thing.
You for the next one? What are you going to...
That leaves me high and dry. Let someone else dry.
Do it?
Yeah. No, I actually am going to get started very soon, actually, with... just Mark Patterson, who's the drummer. He and I are just gonna just make some loops, I think, and I'll see. Jim is not gonna produce it. Just like time constraints. I mean,
yeah.
We spent a long time on that record, and neither of us have that kind of time to
right
do that kind of record again. At the moment, anyway.
Right. Yeah. But you know when you're going to start? No idea?
As soon as I get this mic back from from the soldering guy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's not a mic. It's a preamp that I really love on the kick drum. It's just just has this great warmth to it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it old, or can you divulge its name?
Oh, it's a 2001. It's just like this little box, tube pre.
Yeah.
And it's a 2001.
Right.
I don't know much about it.
But it sounds good.
Yeah, it really sounds good. The kick sounds so good with that on it. Yeah.
So you put this out like a year ago?
Yes.
And have you toured and what was that like? Do you go out? Are you constantly on the road?
That was a little frustrating. I do tour a lot, but mostly solo, and that's the frustrating part is that, you know, we basically made a band record, and I had no band to show up
right.
for or with, you know, and that was frustrating. I think it was frustrating definitely for me. I don't think, you know, the right cards weren't set up to move it along, honestly, so.
Okay.
I don't blame anybody in particular but me, I guess, you know.
Oh.
You know,
No, I understand.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I put the record out myself, and I hired I did a Kickstarter thing to pay for the publicist and the radio person, and... None of that really, I don't know. It was frustrating. What can I say? Yeah.
Well, it's frustrating, and it's weird because we've been given, now we have the power to do everything. You can record at your house, you know.
Yeah.
You can, you know, you did all this stuff. You made the plan. You know.
Yeah, I did
as far as I'm concerned, you did everything.
Yeah,
But, you know, send out some CDs to people, But by the time the record comes out, this happened to me with the last record that I made, was that I was just exhausted.
Yeah,
I was burnt out.
Yeah, I do not enjoy that process, the process of the post, you know, the you have the album in your hand, physical album, and then you have to get it out there, and that part is...
It's not really what we do.
No, and it's just the extra job that I really am not that good at, frankly, you know. And
right, and you're already doing the thing that you're good at, but all this does is detract time-wise from doing the thing that you're actually good at.
Right.
Which was the thing that was frustrating to me about it.
Yeah, it is very frustrating to me as well. I mean, I liked putting the record out, making the record myself, but... it's not.
Have you dealt with labels before? Were you on?
Yes, I've been on just
smaller indies.
Small indies. I had a few development deals with majors, but basically all my records came out on indie labels. Right. Yeah.
So you're from Ohio.
Yeah.
What's the name of the town?
Mingo? Mingo Junction.
Mingo Junction.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that steel mill town?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, the cover of that record is, the new record is shot like in this diner in Mingo Junction.
Your parents still live there? Or
no. My sister lives nearby, and my nephew lives in Pittsburgh, which is also nearby. And I had, he's a photographer, so I had him come and meet me there. And,
oh, cool.
And we did a lot of photo shoots around the steel mills.
What was that like? What was it like growing up there? Were you guys, did your dad work for the steel mill?
Yeah,
was
yeah,
it like
yeah.
a family?
Yeah, yeah. And I actually had summer jobs there for a while.
Doing what? Like, working, what do you do in a steel mill? Like pushing
up.
Stuff?
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, the first job, they put you on the labor gang, it's called, you know.
What's
and
that?
It's like a bunch of guys go around and clean up grease. You know, you go in the grease pit.
Yeah.
You wear these sealed rubber suits where you just sweat like hell. And you go down there and you just shovel grease
Ew.
Out of the pits.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very disgusting job. And then, you know, they moved me around a bunch. Like, I ran a crane. Which was like a very bad idea.
Were you a teenager?
On their part. Yeah. I'm like, I told them, I was like, you know what? This is not a good idea. Me up here hauling like tons of steel.
Right. Like, yeah, over people's heads.
Over
probably.
People's
yeah.
heads.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Very bad idea. So, anyway, and I had a lot of crazy jobs.
What was
glass furnace where the molten steel comes out?
Oh.
I mean, just insane stuff, yeah.
And you're like a little guy that takes big guys kind of work. Like,
yeah,
I've
yeah,
always
yeah.
been scared of big guys.
You know, the thing that scared me the whole time is I was going to get my hand cut off.
So you were, when did you start playing?
Yeah, see, I was playing at that
okay.
time, and, you know, and it used to freak me out. Like, all the work was so, like, you know, you can just lose a limb.
At any second.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, I find those jobs fascinating.
Yeah.
There was a reality show about people that worked on oil rigs, and I
oh,
watched
right,
it religiously.
Right. Oh, yeah,
I am totally fascinated with
oh, man.
A death-defying job.
No, well, these jobs are very scary, you know.
Yeah. So when, how did you start playing? What was the, were your parents into music? Or?
No, they weren't. I just heard music on, and just, it gave me the, like, this feeling of you know, escape.
Yeah,
you know, I lived in this mill town, and
yeah,
there was nothing there, and to hear someone singing in a way that moved me and moved me into another place,
right,
that was really what, you know, got me going.
Yeah. So what was the first, like, do you remember the song or whatever it was where you were like, okay, I'm gonna do this, and got a guitar?
It was, you know, there were songs on the radio, you know, Everly Brothers, and I remember when I was very, very young, there was a song called Sink the Bismarck.
Yeah.
By Johnny Horton.
Yeah.
And the first time I heard it, it just blew my mind. It was like this whole movie in a three-minute, you know, I was just totally in love with that. But, you know, later, I was in grade school, I guess in 7th or 8th grade, I went to a concert, a folk concert, and this guy got up and sang that Dylan song, just like Tom Thumb's Blues.
Yeah.
And that's when I decided that's what I was going to do, because I was so blown away by that song.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what'd you do? Did you ask for a guitar?
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
Yes,
and
I
then
asked
you just,
for a guitar.
Did you take lessons? And
I took lessons for a short time. Actually, this is great. I took lessons from the guy who wrote Play That Funky Music, White Boy.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, Bobby Parisi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he was living there?
Yeah. Yeah, he grew up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
By this time, was he post...
Yeah, you must do that song. You're right.
You know what's really funny, Michael, is we played that with Zach Galifianakis the other night on drums.
Oh, really?
We don't officially play that song.
Oh, really?
If people have had enough drinks in the band, somebody starts playing it.
Yeah, that's so funny.
But yeah, I think Zach started it.
Uh-huh.
It was weird. He was terrible. But so you started taking lessons. Did you start playing out? Was there like a coffee shop? Like what?
No, there was nowhere to play. Well, no, I take that back.
How did the dream work for you? You just had to get out of there.
I had to learn how to play. And then I found this guy in college. My sister went to college there in Steubenville, and he was a folk singer, and he was dating my sister, so he came by with Dylan records, and I was like, oh my god.
How old were you?
I was in eighth grade.
Okay.
And so he gave me lessons. He was really actually quite good, and he taught me how to finger pick, and so I learned, you know, how to play folk style guitar, and you know, immediately wanted to sing for people. You know, in my shy, reticent way, though.
Right, right.
You know, I'm not like that outgoing, but you know, I also wanted people to hear me sing. So
right.
I started bringing. There were event days in high school, and I remember I was in the French club, and I was backing some girl singing a French song for the whole school. This is great. And so, you know, I did a poor job as her backup. She sang Michelle, that, you know, the Beatles song. And that was not easy for me. I think I got through it okay, yeah. But not, you know, I don't think I knew enough to arrange it correctly,
right,
basically, is what I'm saying. And but anyway, there was a big gap of time left after the you know, it was a club day, but the whole school was there, and they couldn't, like, release everybody.
Oh, right.
So this French nun teacher of mine said, Michael, go out there and play them some songs. So I went, like, just got out in front of this, the whole school, you know, 1,000 kids, and sang Coming Into Los Angeles, that, you know, that Arla guy?
No.
Coming into London from over the border, flying in a big jetliner, chicken flying everywhere. Anyway, it's Coming Into Los Angeles, bringing in a couple of keys. Don't touch my bags.
At a Catholic school.
Yeah. If you please, Mr. Customs Man. And just got a standing ovation. It was just like, the kids went crazy.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
But did the nuns were oblivious?
They were oblivious to the bringing in a couple of keys. That meant nothing to them, right?
I have to tell you this, share this with you, because it's funny. A couple of years ago, Skyrocket was hired to play a Catholic school fundraiser. And they came, they wrote us an email that was like, hey, look, we want to have fun, but there's these songs have this kind of thing.
No,
and we got to take out this song, and this song's about heroin, so we can't have this. And they decided to show Saturday Night Fever behind us while we played, but no one took the time to actually watch it. So there's like a scene where John Travolta is like hanging out in a strip club.
Really? Oh, that's great.
I remember looking, like seeing everyone's face kind of like looked up behind us, and there it was, big naked lady.
Great. That's so great.
So you got it past the nuns, and the people freaked out.
They loved it, yeah. So anyway, I started, you know, playing at school functions. There was a dance on Friday nights, the St. Al's dance, and there was a band there that I knew some of the guys in the band, and they used to let me get up and sing, you know, just, I forget what song, you know, House of the Rising Sun, you know, not
right.
In more in the James Burton kind of way,
right,
not in the folk way, but, you know, the kind of the pop songs that were popular at that time.
Right.
So I just desired to be on stage.
Yeah.
You know, albeit there was nowhere really for me as a folk singer to play. And then the college had a coffee house, and then I started going up there and doing the open mic thing and that.
So how did that, did people like you?
I don't remember too much. Well, yeah, actually I did get a gig from it, but I was probably really, I think back at the material,
I
think I was horrible, you know? God, it was like self-indulgent, like crap.
And you were in high school?
Was writing, yeah.
So how did you get out of Mingo Junction? What was college?
College, yeah. I went to Ohio State.
Okay.
Yeah.
And stuff, there's a little more stuff going on in Columbus.
Oh, yeah. It was like a total hippie revolution there, you know, when I was in school. And not as cool as Athens, Ohio, where OSU is.
Okay.
They were totally hip, very cool.
Yeah.
Campus there. But yeah.
Yeah, so tell me about that. So you did you start playing there too? And
same deal. I was in school and kind of not sure of myself and would go to the coffee house and watch other people. And I think by that point I got more and more insecure, actually. I didn't play much at that time. Not until just before I graduated. Then I started actually getting gigs, and turned out... after my first record came out here in 1990, my first gig in Columbus was at the same place that I played like 20 years prior to that.
Yeah.
Like, it was called Stash and Little Brothers, and I got a gig there.
Right.
And there I was playing there again. I was like, Jesus, man, this is crazy.
Were you writing songs then when you were in college?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think they were okay, but, you know, I certainly don't go back to any of that material. None of that material has ended up, you know.
Right.
Got recycled, really.
Right. When did you move to New York City then?
In 1978.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like? You don't seem like you went there for the Studio 54 vibe.
But that's what it was like. Oh, it was a crazy. New York was so different in the 80s. I mean, oh my God.
Yeah.
It was
dirty.
Yeah. Well, I remember the day I moved into my apartment. Like, I went there and lived on Long Island for a couple of weeks and would take the train into Manhattan. And I was staying with some friends. And I would take the train in and look for a place to live, and right. I found a place in Chelsea.
Do you have a job, or did you?
I didn't at the time, no. So I took the train in, and then I found this place in Chelsea. And I remember the day I moved in, it was like a Sunday night, and this is Chelsea, which is like very a hip happening neighborhood now, but it was like bleak. It was like tumbleweeds going down 8th Avenue.
Right.
It was a windy night, so it literally did have that kind of deserted Western town feel to it. But then I got a job at this data development coding place where I had to like read like is it sticky? Is it sweet? You know, like, you know, you they're testing products. Oh,
okay.
Out.
Yeah.
And when I walked in there, There was this guy wearing a sombrero, this gigantic sombrero, and sunglasses and a Hawaiian shirt. And I looked at him and I thought, holy shit, that's Peter Stanfield of the Holy Modal Rounders, the Fugs. They were these punk folk bands that he fronted. He was like you mentioned Andy Warhol. He was part of that whole crowd.
Yeah.
But in a folk version of that,
right.
He had these really crazy, crazy folk bands.
Wow, and that's there pretty he was. To end up
yeah,
there.
So I got to know him, and he was great. I, you know, hung out with him a bunch. And
did he introduce you to the scene, or what kind of scene did
well,
you end
up
in?
Well, he was kind of semi-retired from that scene at that point. You know, he was no longer in a band, and... you know, he was studying, really, really studying, like, the Appalachian folk scene. So, you know, I knew a great deal about it myself, so it was fun. You know, we would just jam together at his place and bring other musicians. Yeah.
And meet people like that. How did you end up playing out?
Well, I just went to the open mics every Monday night, like... endless. Not discriminate either. I would go to like where they were singing mama, you know, show tunes, and indiscriminately going to open mics all over Manhattan that I had no business going to.
Right.
They were just so bad.
It's a good thing karaoke wasn't around then.
Right, thank God. Yeah.
So what kind of scene did you end up at? Like, at one point, weren't you in like a kind of a folk scene? Yes, I was.
There was an article that came out while I was, before I moved there, I read about this scene, the folk scene in the West Village, and mentioned Folk City, of course. And there's another place called the Cornelia Street Cafe, which they had this Monday night thing where not only was it an open mic, but you had to have a new song. You couldn't just get up there and do your routine.
Oh, right. Oh, that's good.
So I started going there, and that really changed my perspective. You know, it pushed me to write, and people, you know, critiqued you after.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, it was super great. I mean, I you know, the people I met there are still dear friends. You know, a lot of them are you know, there's a great deal of them still perform and tour.
Right. Any good people that we might know? Anybody?
Well, Suzanne Vega was part of that scene. Right. She was probably the most prominent. Steve Forbert was in that scene. And Lucy Kaplansky is still, you know, and Cliff Eberhardt still gets around. David Massengill, you know, they're all, you know, touring. And anyway, so I started going to that scene, and I got asked to be on like this record label got involved, and this is how the scene ended, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A record label got involved and decided these guys are going to be on the record, and the rest of everybody else wasn't. And I was one of the people they chose to be on the Cornelia Street Cafe record.
Okay, yeah.
And so then this schism happened. The people that weren't asked were offended, and the ones who were on it, you know, were, how did you get on this record?
Yeah.
And that kind of thing happened. And so from that, this other group started the co-op, like this folk record, like they put their own records out,
right,
just like that record that the Cornelia Street Cafe put out.
Right.
On a label the co-op put out as a co-op. And, you know, I actually ended up on a couple of their records, and so did Sean Colvin.
Was she living up there then?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And she had a great cut on, and again, Suzanne and other, yeah, everybody was on those co-op records. They were kind of fair about it, yeah.
You did that for like a decade, a little over a decade.
I really got away from the folk scene pretty quickly. As soon as I discovered like CBGBs and that scene, I kind of drifted away. In fact, my first real gig, it was at Kenny's Castaways, you know, where I was actually getting paid, and he wanted me to have a band, and I'd never played with a band, so, you know, I got this great guy to put a band together for me, and then start playing, you know, bought an electric guitar and an amp.
Oh, wow.
Still don't play him very well, but, you know.
Yeah.
But felt compelled to get out there and do it, and once I started doing that, I just continued in that direction. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
And so I start getting gigs at like CBGBs and
was it Michael Fricasso or did you have a band?
Yeah, it was Michael Fricasso and Spaghetti Western was the.
So you were still kind of playing a more traditional style of music. It wasn't like if I looked it up on YouTube, you're playing like a guitar or something.
It was pretty singer songwriter ish, but I did have synth players and you know that sort of thing by mid '80s, And, you know, like, I would, you know, Hilly at CBGB's, I mean, I would just go in there and say, hey, can I play? And he goes, well, do you want to play solo or are you playing with a band? And he didn't care.
Yeah.
I mean, I would go sometimes and just open up for a rock band, just play total solo gig.
Yeah. And so, that way preceded the gallery, right?
Yes. Okay. It was way before the gallery was there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they didn't have that. I was like one of probably the few people who would get up there with my guitar.
Yeah, you had balls.
Yeah, yeah. So they didn't, you know, I think he probably saw that more than anything else. I mean, I didn't realize how ballsy that might have been.
Right.
But it just seemed totally natural to me.
Who was up and coming at that time in that scene? Because that's post-Ramones, post-Blondie. That's like the
80s. Yeah, it was post-Ramones and Blondie. They were all, you know, everyone Talking Heads was gone. Although they, you know, they had just gone.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were... let me think who played there. There was a band that I love called Urban Blight.
Was it still primarily
like Hoy Boy and the Doys? I mean, they were they were great. Rockabilly was big at that in those early 80s. So there were a lot of rockabilly acts that I loved.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
And is that kind of what your band was like, the Spaghetti Western?
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you, I guess you kind of have come like this.
Yeah,
this,
I used to wear like a bolo and, you know, it was like total rockabilly, fake singer-songwriter doing rockabilly, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah.
I wish right now I could just flash a promo picture.
Oh, yeah. I have a poster of me with like, you know, the what is like a surf blue jacket with a.
Oh, yeah.
Like a coral shirt and a bolo tie. Yeah. And yeah.
So how did New York run its course for you? Were you traveling at that point much, or were you just playing?
No, I never did a gig out. I finally, the last year I was in New York, I started venturing. I bought a car and I started going to Boston, you know, checking out the scene there. And then I got a gig upstate, like at this bar. It was a terrible gig, but it was a gig nonetheless.
Outside of town.
Yeah. It was my first gig. I was like on the road.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I had a gig there and on Thursdays. And then I got a gig where... Chris Whitley and I were friends, and he had a gig at this place called Brothers Barbecue on Friday, and I got a gig there on Wednesdays. So it was cool. It was like a really cool gig.
Yeah.
So I started doing that every week. I had a weekly gig in Manhattan, which was a huge deal.
Yeah.
But I also had a production deal, and I had a big time manager, and I gave him a time frame. I said, "Look, I've been through this so many times
now."
Oh,
the production deal kind of thing.
I'm giving you to this, and then I'm leaving New York, because I talked to this woman Karen Berg. She passed away a few years ago, but she was big. Time A&R person at A&M. And she was a fan, and she used to come to hear me play, and we talked a lot, and she said, "Man, you just need to get out of New York and find it, you know,
right,
get some experience elsewhere."
Yeah.
And I had already been thinking in those terms, so I gave the production deal like 6 months to get me, you know, a real deal.
And what did the production deal entail? They gave you some
money?
Oh,
they gave me money that went right into the studio.
Right.
And the
so they just gave you a budget, but you had to turn up with some songs.
The budgets were pretty good. Yeah. I mean, they were high, and especially in those days, you know, the studios were very expensive. And,
oh, yeah.
And but you know, it wasn't like I was making any money as an artist. I was still just, you know, putting money back right into the music world and never seeing a dime of it hardly in that way.
And so you turn in a certain amount of songs, and then at the end of the 6 months, they tell you whether or not it's going to happen.
Yeah. And so I mean, you probably have gone through that.
I never had a development deal.
Yeah, it's no, weird.
I kind of did in publishing, but it all kind of fell apart. So
yeah. So I had this development deal, and I turned out one set of songs, and the first session had like Will Lee playing bass, and
wow.
Hugh McCracken on guitar.
Wow.
I mean, it was like total super session guys. Yeah. Will, you know, I actually knew him. He would come and hear me play, and
right.
And one day after a gig, he said, "Hey, if you ever need a bass player, you know, wow. I'm there for you." And so this deal came up, and I said, "Well, I'm just going to ask Will to be the bass player." And he got the other guys.
Wow.
The drummer is playing
with Anton Figg?
No, he's playing with who was he playing with?
The famous people.
Yeah, some famous person anyway. So that deal, but you know, it just there was nothing. The producers were so enthralled with the session guys.
Right.
They totally like ignored me. I was like, chop liver. What am I, chop liver?
Yeah, you know, that new. Yeah.
So anyway, it sounds like that to me. Except for I did this cover of Town Without Pity, which I love. I mean, it came out really perfect.
Yeah.
But the other stuff. So then I wanted to produce the next sessions. So I did. And I found this band that was playing in the street.
Which is always a major label's most exciting thing. Like, I'm going to produce it myself, and it's not going to be the guys from The Late Show. It's going to be some dudes I found
in
the subway.
Yeah. Actually, though, you know, like this woman, Rochelle Garnier, is just like, she's big time.
Okay.
Yeah, she's really great. So she had this little band, and they were great. And so I brought them in the studio as my backup band, and... Oh man, it was really good. Although, I probably didn't do as good. I could have used a producer who had a better. My production was getting that band, and that was a good idea.
Right.
But I didn't deliver it the other end of it. You know, in the studio was a little.
Were you pressured? Did you feel a little weird once you were in there and it was like, oh, shit. Like,
no, I just didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Right.
You know?
So then you left and you came to Austin.
Right, so why I gave Austin? Them those, I
sorry,
don't know.
Sorry, you were going to say
No. I just gave them you know, the two different sessions, and they had, you know, no, and I was gone.
Yeah.
So I came to Austin because I think... I read this again. That's funny. I guess I'm easily influenced, but Michael Corcoran had written an article in Spin in the late 80s about the Austin music scene. And there was everything here, you know, just, you know, the Butthole Surfers who used to play at CBGB's all the time.
Right.
And then, you know, Towns Van Zandt, and,
right?
You know, so I was like, "Wow,
yeah,
that's just like living in New York, but you know, without the eating shit every day."
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's how come I moved here.
And that's around the time I met you, right? You were making a record at the Congress House.
Was that the first record when I met you?
I think so.
Might have been.
That's right. 1991, and I think it was like your record they were making when I moved
in. That's right. Yeah.
So
that's so funny.
Yeah.
I forgot all about that. You were like the...
I was like the guy that lived
T-boy.
In the studio. Yeah. I was a T-boy a lot. Yeah. I was a cappuccino boy. I don't think anyone was drinking tea at that time unless they were ill.
It's funny.
But so you were welcomed when you got here because I remember people loved you.
Yeah, no, it was just a great, great place for me. Yeah.
And you hit the ground... You were on a label then. It was an indie label, right?
It was an indie label, yeah. Deja Disc.
Yeah. So that was the first, your first
My
record.
My first real record, yeah. Like first, yeah. And that was fun. I mean, a lot of that, though, was made by the first, I actually made the record first.
Okay.
And then got signed, and then we went and recut some of the record.
Okay.
After I got signed. And added a couple tracks and changed a couple tracks, but
And then
I produced it, and I, you know,
you went on tour.
I went on tour. I actually, I don't know how I did this, but I devised a tour. I found, you know, Jimmy LaFave was a big, you know, was had a big yeah. buzz. And so I asked him and David Halley, who's like my favorite songwriter, and Joe Carroll Pierce, who's also one of my favorite songwriters.
Yeah.
I said, let's do this Austin the Boston tour. I had a manager at the time, and she went out and got a sponsorship with like BMI, with you know, beer companies. So we had money, a booking agent, and they booked us nationally. You know, Austin, you know, songwriters on the road. And
did you guys all travel together?
Yeah, yeah, we traveled in a van. Yeah, yeah, it was okay. You know, no. It was. I enjoyed it because Jimmy is so entertaining to travel with. I mean, he listens to like the craziest kind of. At that time, the joke tapes were very faddish.
Yeah.
And it was endless.
Like the crank calls.
Yeah, the crank calls. Yeah. So it was amusing. It was amusing. Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah.
And so was your first trip kind of traveling with the group?
Yeah, and I went like. Yeah, the whole solo country, now, basically, what was, with that band.
What was, group. What was, like, obviously, they had probably all toured a lot with groups, or no?
No.
Like, Jim, no one was, like, burnt out, but you're like, hey, we're in, you know, yeah. Michigan. This is awesome.
Right? Yeah. I you know, they were like, oh, fuck this fall foliage. I want to go back to Texas. And I was like, oh, my God, we're in Maine, you know, like.
Yeah.
I was just like so ecstatic to be I love being on the road. I think it's just fun.
Yeah, it is fun.
You know, and you get a lot out of it. Yeah, I really enjoy it. So they were a little like, literally, fuck this fall foliage. Yeah, I want to go back to Texas. Yeah, they were all Texan. I was the only non-Texan on that run. So,
and also on your first big. You know, road trip.
Yeah.
Plan.
Yeah. I think, again, I don't think any of them had any seasoned road anything. Like, right. Jimmy was doing a lot of local bar scene, but right. not getting beyond Texas at that point, yeah. really. So.
So when you guys came back, then you, was that Hamilton Pool?
Yeah, that was next? Mark and Ian Matthews. Yeah. I did that. I put out a record during next that? And then Hamilton Pool kind of in between that.
Okay.
Yeah.
How what happened? What was
Hamilton Pool?
Yeah, how was that idea? Just like everyone was like, well, let's pull our things together.
Yeah, Mark and Ian approached me after a show. I was playing the Cactus Cafe and they were at my show and they approached me with the idea of them backing me up.
Okay.
And I'm like, I can't do that. Because I had seen them singing together. I'm like, I'm not that kind of singer.
Right.
So
like Crosby, Stills, and Nash.
Yeah, right, yeah, right. Yeah. So they came back to me again and, you know, said, look, we'll get you through this. We'll, you know, we'll be your kind of like... But truth be told, I was just always uncomfortable in that band.
Sure.
Never had any comfort level ever.
Yeah.
It was really hard for me. And I look back at it like it could have been successful if I maybe, I don't know. I just, you know, you can't do the coulda, shoulda thing. And,
right, right. Well, I was just in a band that's like that, like with multiple singers, and it's hard.
Yeah, I found it really. Well, you're probably. I mean, I'm not that. I was, especially at that time, had no experience with singing harmonies.
Right.
Zero.
Yeah, I'm still not that great at it.
I'm not that great at it, and so Ian, who is super great at it,
and Holman, who's ridiculous.
He's ridiculous as well. So I was really uncomfortable because I never knew what the fuck I was doing. Also, you know what I mean?
I know, but also all I can think is both of Ian's and Mark's personalities and you and David's personalities. It must have been so hard.
Oh, God. Traveling was what broke my back.
Yeah.
On that band.
So you guys did travel. Yeah. I remember you put out a record, but I couldn't remember.
We did. We toured on that record a little bit, not that much, but we were, you know, we went through the Midwest and East Coast, never made it west, but it was not fun. It was the first time I had no fun.
Right.
And maybe even my worst tours, you know, as Michael Fracasso, were not as bad as that to me.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, my worst tours are really horrible for other reasons.
Right.
But I at least I had camaraderie when, you know, when the van broke down and we're on the side of a highway and we're missing our gig and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
At least, you know, we were together and kind of could laugh about it.
Right.
But we couldn't laugh about stuff in Hamilton Pool, it
seemed.
Why is that?
Seems people were in different places.
It's just like we just had different personalities, and it was just what we weren't meshing up at all.
Sometimes the supergroup is weird.
Yeah. That's you know that
they're good ideas.
Yeah, fine idea at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
So then after that, you finished that. You came back. You made another record, or you just
So I did. When I Lived in the Wild, and that got really great reviews, and also got me touring, you know, a lot, and then I made a record with Charlie Sexton, which I think is like this really brilliant record.
Me too.
I love that record, and I put a band together to go out, and I put a lot of money into it. I had a label, but they weren't fronting me, you know, the
tour support.
Right. And things just fell apart. It was like big time, I think the label hired the wrong radio promotion and the wrong, you know, everything, publicist. Right. I think that they wanted to see me as a folk singer, and because I wasn't that, everybody who started out liking me were stopped. Turned off by that record.
Okay.
You know, the record, I like I said, I love that record.
Yeah,
I just love that record, but it just, you know, the real you know, the Nazi, I was thinking of somebody, but I thought I better not say his name. You know, they didn't want to hear me doing like pop music.
Right.
You know, so it just fell apart.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah.
It's always weird, isn't it? There's like, you can be so enamored with the work that
you're
doing.
I love
and you're like,
that
oh, this
record.
Is really
this
good.
Is
everyone's
like
going to see me in a whole new light.
Right,
I'm going to break these walls down. Right, and then people are like, what?
Yeah.
Michael, you get your acoustic guitar, get those weird guitar loops
Yeah, exactly. Get that loop. What is this loop shit? And, you know, oh, God.
How was it working with Charlie? I mean, he's a phenomenal musician and just soulful.
Just everything.
Guy.
Phenomenal is a good word for working with him. We just got along so well. I loved it. I mean, it was a funny process. I would go in, he would make loops. I would play him the song. He would make loops. I would sing the song. And then we would talk about it, like what I heard or how I'd come back in a couple of days and he had made this like beautiful soundscape around it.
Yeah. Was he pretty much playing everything on that
record? Yes. Yes.
And then you guys went out with you.
No, never. We went up to Oklahoma and recorded a live record.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but that was it. I mean, he never toured with me.
It's funny because just knowing that record makes me think that you, and maybe I saw you.
We played in town all the time, and he did all my local shows with me. Yeah, yeah.
What a phenomenal person to have up there with you. You know, did it make you a better player? You think better singer and better
everything? I mean,
he also doesn't suffer bullshit in any way.
No,
like
No,
hackiness. He likes people to be on their game.
Yeah, yes, he does. Yes, he does. I remember after we did that live record, I was a little despondent, you know, after the recording.
Right.
And he was like, "Michael, what's wrong?" I'm like, "Oh man, Charlie, I don't know." It's like I just thought it was like I had totally let him down.
Right.
And he was like, "Oh man, no, you're so wrong."
Aww.
You know, and it was so funny because, like, I thought the first half of that show was just awful.
Right.
And then
is
the
that
second,
live at the Blue Door?
Yeah,
is
yeah.
The record, yeah.
And then the second half was like, okay, like I think we, you know, may have gotten something out of that second half. Well, guess what? We used nothing out of the second half.
Oh, really? It's all the first.
Yeah, it's all the first half, and it's like.
So how did you did two shows? Is that how you did it? You recorded?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a good.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Seems
yeah.
like the only way to really do it.
Yeah. And but yeah, I you know, I'm so hard on myself sometimes, and it's hard to produce yourself that way, and
yeah.
That's why it's good to have someone like Charlie who's like, "No, man.
That was
you're
good.
Crazy."
Yeah.
Yeah. And just
that's good.
Get a step aside, Michael.
Yeah.
Don't put a wrench in this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that record came out, and then you just kept on touring? And
yeah, that
like...
record, although I never hired anybody, I put it out myself.
Probably did the best of...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Totally. Only record I ever really made money on.
Cost nothing to make.
Nothing
probably.
To make, yeah. And just... And it's still to this day, like, people love that record.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. So I went and toured on that, and then I got on another little indie, the Lone Star Music, and put out a couple records with them.
That was in the late 90s?
No, it was in the early 2000s, like 2003. Okay. Did those, and those did nothing again. It was just very frustrating. The wrong people. Like, you know when you're talking to someone and you don't listen to that voice saying, this
yeah.
person is bullshit. This,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and I didn't listen to that voice. Oh, you know, what time is it, Johnny?
It's 11:30.
Oh, okay, perfect.
Right, you have to be there at 12?
Yeah, I'm fine.
Okay. Yeah, we're fine.
I'm hearing that voice, and I'm like, this person is such an asshole.
Yeah.
And then I let them talk me into hiring that very asshole, you know.
Person
and,
you shouldn't hire.
Yeah, anyway, so, and I think that record is really good. Maybe, again, I shouldn't have produced it, maybe. It's not bad, but it could have been better.
When you were going,
I always feel that. Like even the next one I produced again, called Red Dog Blues, and that was like 2008. And I thought, if I just had stuck to my guns, that would have been a great, great album. Instead, there's some great songs on it.
And some people talked you into changing stuff. The assholes.
No, I just was on a time and budget.
Okay.
I did it not at my place. I did it in the studio, and I had a certain budget, and I just was thinking we'd record and make the record in 10 days, basically, you know.
Right.
And some of it's great, and
yeah.
some of it needed to be... I had ideas that
right.
that I was reticent with, and I should have just stuck with them.
Right.
You know.
Well, lessons learned.
Yeah, hard knocks. Yeah.
So during that time, you did touring. You toured with Patty Griffin some, didn't you?
Yeah, a couple times.
Those worked out well. For you, the
crowds
liked you.
Yeah, they were very good.
Yeah. So I guess the next record after the 2008 one is Saint Monday.
Yeah.
And now you're preparing to go do a new record.
Yeah. Yeah.
Writing songs, waiting for your mic to get fixed from the soldering shop.
Yeah.
When do you think that'll be out?
I would like to have it, you know, out next spring. You know, this coming spring, I guess, is what we're talking about. So, yeah.
It's hard to keep the cycle up as much as, you know. Yeah, especially now when you have to do it yourself and find the time and tour and...
It is, and find the financing. Right. It's like all that stuff takes...
How did
so
the Kickstarter work out for you? Were you happy with the outcome?
Oh, yeah. It was more than I expected.
I feel like that phenomenon has slowed down in like the last 6 months.
I'm not going back to it. I just felt like, oh, that was fun, but I'm not comfortable doing it again, and I'm not sure why.
Did you give away anything weird?
Oh, yeah. I gave away dinners that I cooked.
Oh, right. Let's talk about, because you are a well-known Italian
cook.
Yeah,
I'm actually
cook.
Writing a cookbook.
Are you?
Yeah. It's going to come out soon. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So, what, cooking your whole life because you're Italian and that happened in your house? Your grandma or something?
No, my mom. Yeah.
Can everyone in your family cook? Is that like a...
No. Oh. No. Whenever I show up at one of my sister's house, she was like, goes grocery shopping for me.
Oh, right.
So I'll cook dinner for them. So I was like, great, I love that. No, I don't know. It was something I just remember buying a cookbook one day and just like felt it go through me. Like I absorbed it I absorbed nothing else in my life. Like I could taste and smell the food as I read it, and I thought, "Wow, I'm gonna go do this," and started making stuff like right away, and it was like it came so naturally.
And I'm gonna vouch for you. You were into making food way before it became the coolest thing in the world to do. Before the word foodie came out.
Hate all that stuff, and I'm not that kind of person.
And
there is
that phenomenon where people watch a show and they're like,
right.
Oh, me and Mario Batali are like,
this is definitely, I'm not a foodie book.
But you teach cooking classes? Do you
do
that regularly?
I do. I do private class. I'm like, I'm going to someone's house this month to do something. And
that's cool.
I do them in cooking schools.
And what, do you have a specialty, Italian food?
Just Italian food. Not traditional Italian food. Yeah. Not your Neapolitan kind of spaghetti and meatballs or that kind of thing. I don't really.
What is it? It's like...
It's actually traditional in the sense that Italians use a lot of vegetables, and it's not always about, like, you know... I think the antipasta dishes are, like, some of the best things that you can get in Italian food, and so there's a lot of that. And I as a cook, I've kind of invented my own version I don't follow, like, I read a lot of recipes
and it's like jazz,
I'm a jazz that's great, man. I love that. I riff out man
you know the parameters, but you change what you can in there.
I like to riff out on my food. Yeah, it's good, Johnny.
Are there any classes coming up that people might know about?
Yeah, like I said, it's just that private one. And then once the cookbook comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can find you at michaelfricasso.com.
Yeah.
Buy records there.
Yes.
And you can find you to be like, hey, will you come teach me how to cook?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's good.
Michaelfricasso.com. We'll be there.
I will be there. And Ed, you have a show coming up at Poor David's Pub this week. Am I right?
No, Anderson Fair.
Okay.
In Houston.
Okay.
Not this week, next week.
There isn't a show with Jimmy LaFave coming up?
At Poor... Oh, I do.
Yeah. <You're> amazing.
Thank you.
I reminded you. Maybe you'd be home on Friday.
Yeah. I'll be like, hold on. What should I do tonight? Holy shit, I have a gig.
Yeah.
I have a gig at Poor David's and then in Pampa, Texas. That's one of Jimmy's I'm opening for Jimmy there. I have no idea what that is, but Pampa, Texas.
Is he still into the comedy tape? I need to get him on here.
Is he not? Yeah, I'll tell him. I'll see him.
You know what?
He's a guy that
there's a phenomenon. We always say hi to each other by each other's names, but I don't think we've ever met.
Oh, yeah.
He'll go like, hey, Johnny. And I'll be like, hey Jimmy. How you doing? And he'll be like, good, how are you? I'm like, good.
That's it.
That's right? It.
Yeah.
For like almost 20 years now.
There you go.
It's totally good, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's really friendly and nice.
Yeah, yeah. You guys have a good relationship.
Without having to work at it.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, you know?
I wonder what's ever going to happen to that song that we wrote for that pilot.
I don't know. Did you ever hear anything about it?
I heard... all they did was send us that video that time.
Right.
I wonder if we're allowed to put it out, let people hear it.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
That would really... Oh, yeah, we should talk to that dude.
Yeah, Steve.
Steve.
I'll talk to him.
Yeah.
I'll find him. I'll track him down.
He was looking for a production deal, right?
Yeah, there was going to be a TV show where people...
write songs together and
of course, it wouldn't
struggle.
Make it because neither of us are like born rich. And,
yeah, yeah.
And like with... you know, weird dating a celebrity.
He probably
and
have a sex
has tape.
like 15-year-olds on there now. Like, yeah. Wrong. Yeah.
Hey, you have kids?
I do.
Yeah. How old are they?
They just turned 12 and 9.
Wow.
Yeah. They have the same birthday.
Really?
Last week, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yep.
Well, and tell Paula that I said hi.
Thank you. I will.
I haven't seen her in a long time. Yeah. And thanks for being. Is there anything I'm forgetting?
Oh gosh, I don't think so. We pretty much gave it to Michael Fracasso.
Yeah. This is how Michael Fracasso got here. The history of Michael Fracasso 101.
Yeah.
Well, man, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me.
All right, have a good songwriting session.
Okay.
I love that guy, Michael Fracasso. What a great guy. I would love to share that song that we wrote. We went and wrote this song in a day and recorded it that evening live with a band that was really good. And it was going to be a pilot for a TV show, I guess. It didn't get picked up. Anyway, I'd like to thank Michael for taking the time and coming down and talking to me. It's always great to see him. He's a great guy. Go get his music. St. Monday is his latest album. It's really good. And you kind of heard the beginning of how it was done. We're going to play another song from there now. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes, like us on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter, at Johnny Gowdy. I tweet things, and sometimes they're obscene and rude and insane. And so there you go. That's me. More Michael Fracasso right now. Thank you so much for listening to the show. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
She's a kind that runs around. She won't settle down. Coffee, little lover, tastes so sweet. Just like